Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada, and today's guest is Marcus Pinn.
Hey, what's going on?
Hi, Marcus. You've appeared on numerous podcasts, including several past episodes of FlixWise, but I think I was first introduced to your film work through a series of posts on your blog, Pinland Empire Cult, The School of Andrei Tarkovsky.
Oh, cool.
Where you had a very comprehensive breakdown of his influence on many other filmmakers. And that sort of relates, I think, to the topic we're going to be discussing, which are side-by-sides, which is a phenomenon that I think it's sort of taken off, where you see two or more stills from a film juxtaposed. Also, there's video versions, or sometimes you see a still from a film placed next to a painting or art photograph.
Yep.
But that's something that you've been doing with a high regularity for a long time, and I think with a sort of insight that I don't really find anywhere else from people who regularly post side-by-sides.
Ah, thank you, man. So, and I feel that way about your stuff likewise. I'm not trying to just make this into like a love fest or a blowing smoke, but no, but genuinely there's a lot of accounts, a lot of people do good stuff, but there's like the few kind of like upper echelon folks, if I may, you know, say so. And I definitely, yeah, you're one of my favorite accounts, have been for a while. So yeah.
Thank you. What do you think makes a good side-by-side comparison of film stills?
It depends, because it could just be like an abstract thing. That just happens to look alike, and probably more than likely one did not influence the other, but just when two things that aren't related or probably aren't related look similar, like that's kind of cool. And then other times things are so identical that it looks cool too, but like not so much in an obvious way. Like there's directors, you know, who influenced each other, and it's kind of like, yeah. Oh, well, surprise, surprise there. But then there's other filmmakers that, like, you know, that don't get enough credit for being cinephiles, or you don't associate this filmmaker with the other. And then when you see certain images, you know, next to each other, that's when it, you know, it's like, oh, wow.
It helps when there's a sort of specificity. Like you see some that it's kind of very broad, like it's two shots of people kind of in the center of the frame or something very sort of generic. And I think my favorites are always ones that are very specific in the similarity. Even if it's a total coincidence, it still sort of impacts the way I watch certain films. You think about them differently after comparing it to something else.
Sure.
You know, even if the filmmakers aren't necessarily aware of one another, it makes me think how we try to represent certain images on film, or the differences, minor differences between the way certain filmmakers try to represent the same idea or images.
Absolutely. No, and also, like, it doesn't necessarily have to be, like, there's something that I just kind of recently learned towards the end of last year. Like, take an example, like a guy like Xavier Dolan, who's very, very young. I think people forget, like, how young. I think he's still in his mid-20s. And when Heartbeats came out, it was just like nonstop, like French New Wave, Godard, Godard, Godard. And then in an interview, he said, you know, he's only seen, I think it was like, he said he's only seen one, you know, Godard film. However, there's still like an influence of residue. So it's like, okay, he may have only seen, you know, just Breathless, but he's so young that there's still a generation of filmmakers between Godard and him. So he was probably influenced by filmmakers who were influenced by Godard, and maybe he doesn't even realize that. And that's not to like criticize Xavier Dolan, because for the most part, I'm a fan of his. But because yeah, like that I'm glad that we're doing this talk, because not so much on Twitter, although occasionally you get like snarky stuff, but it's more so there's a the Facebook film group Confessions of a Cinephile. Well, I've kind of for the most part just stopped posting on it, because I get killed for the most part, and it's sad, because the majority of people who actually like the stuff I post there greatly outweighs the negative comments. But like a lot of humans, you get caught up on the negative stuff. But it's like you post like a lot of side by side images, and people are like, you know, those don't even look alike. And it's like, they don't always have to look identical. Like, I mean, the same director reshooting his same movie probably wouldn't get an identical shot if he tried to recreate his own thing. So, you know, but there's just a lot of and people, I think, on that Confessions of a Cinephile group are so quick to just be negative. One, because it's the internet, and when you're anonymous, you can just be negative and mean and angry. But there's just no, like, just from a basic, simple standpoint that, like, the whole idea of, like, comparing movie imagery, it's just a form of, it's, I mean, one, it's history. Not always, because some images that look similar have nothing to do with one another, like I already stated. But then in others, you know, there's plenty of filmmakers who don't have an ego and who can just, like, they'll make a generic statement, like, yeah, I was influenced by this director. But then you have other filmmakers who will just, if you listen to directors' commentaries of certain DVDs and Blu-rays, they'll say, okay, this specific shot I stole from this movie. This specific shot was an homage to this specific scene in this movie. And, you know, and I appreciate that, because as an artist, you don't ever want to be considered a copycat. I understand the whole defensiveness of, like, you know, but I give more props to, you know, to filmmakers who give, you know, like a Jim Jarmusch or a Nicholas Refn, you know, folks like that. Or even, you know, I'm not as gaga about, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson as a lot of people. He's certainly a talented filmmaker. Right. Like, I don't, you know, no, he's good at what he does. But even him, the I don't know if you have the old school Hard Eight DVD with director's commentary, where, like, the scene of Philip Baker Hall and John C. Reilly driving in the desert, Paul Thomas Anderson said straight up, he's like, I stole this from Jonathan Demme's Melvin and Howard. You know, the scene towards the beginning where they're just, like, you know, driving through the desert. And then in Boogie Nights, there's the tracking shot. Oh, well, there's quite a few tracking shots in that movie, but, like, he was just saying, you know, straight up, oh, I took this from Robert Altman. I totally robbed this from Robert Altman. And I like when people say that, because, you know, yeah, you admit to stealing shots, but at the same time, it's like Robert Altman never made a Boogie Nights. Jonathan Demme never made a Hard Eight. I mean, plot-wise, it's still a different movie, so, you know. And just like with Jim Jarmusch, you know, well, I guess the whole Wim Wenders, he early on, he got compared to Wim Wenders a lot, and they actually both made a lot of road movies. So even plot wise, you can find a lot of similarities there. But in terms of, like, another guy he got compared to, like Robert Bresson, like, Bresson would never make a Jarmusch movie, and, like, vice versa.
Right. I was thinking, like, trying to suss out the difference between homage and reference versus outright ripoff. I always think, like, ripoff is at the point when you really are trying to imitate, like, every aspect of another filmmaker's style or film, you know, if it has to be, like, everything like Robert Bresson, and you can't quite do that, you know, because you're not that filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, sort of ripoff films are never really that great. There are filmmakers who, like, I think do get a lot of acclaim, but, you know, I don't necessarily connect with them, because I do sort of feel like their style, it's sort of curated from other respected filmmakers. They can kind of assemble something that looks stylish and artful and meaningful, and it's not necessarily that. But there are filmmakers who I think just have a really original voice and appropriate certain images, certain ways of doing things to kind of prop that up in a way that I think is very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. It's frustrating, though, when you're like trying to point out a connection and people don't buy it. And sometimes, like, there's even a beyond just homage, there's like a direct connection between some of these filmmakers. Like, I remember I don't know, a while ago, somebody was sort of skeptical of me comparing a Catherine Bigelow to Douglas Sirk, but I was like, they knew each other. She knew Sirk personally, so it's like not a stretch, I don't think. You know, and like you said, there are filmmakers who point out where they get things, but others are sort of more tight-lipped, and you never really get that confirmation. But I found, like, you know, if you see one shot, you can't really say, well, I don't know if it's a coincidence or influence. But then you see maybe a couple of shots that resemble something that another filmmaker did, and then it's a couple of shots over several films in another filmmaker's body of work, then you can eventually sort of say, okay, I'm pretty sure this person was influenced by this filmmaker.
I couldn't agree more, which is why between my more later work on Pinland Empire and just what, you know, if you follow me on Twitter, like, I started doing, like, you know, just utilizing Twitter's four images that, you know, they allow you. But then, you know, there was a period on, you know, on Twitter where people were just kind of giving me crap, where it's just like, you could find these shots anywhere. And it was kind of like, all right, well, let me take two movies or two filmmakers and find 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, you know, with each within the same film. And that way, to me, it almost seems like kind of like bulletproof at that point. And, you know, and going back to what you said about Catherine Bigelow and Douglas Sirk, just like, you know, on Confessions of a Cinephile, I was posting a lot of, like, Claire Denis comparisons for those listening that don't know, I'm a big Claire Denis fan. And then I posted, it was, I at this point, I post so many side-by-side comparisons, I can't even remember, but I remember feeling almost forced to being feel, I just felt so arrogant and knowledgeable at these people, because I compared Claire Denis to Wim Wenders. And then a bunch of people came down on me, like, how can you, like, you don't know if she was good. And it's kind of like, well, if you look at a lot of this, like, it's not only, not only was she assistant director on two of his films, she also hung around, she was also around when he made The State of Things. They used some of the same actors, like, they're still friends to this day. Like, there are many layers to that. So it's like, so to say that Claire Denis is influenced by Wim Wenders, not very far-fetched. I mean, just down to the fact that, like, even Agnès Godard, who's Claire Denis' kind of go-to cinematographer, she was the assistant cinematographer in Paris, Texas. Like, it just kind of goes on. You know, Aurora Clement, who was the aunt in Paris, Texas, was in, Trouble Every Day. There's just so many connections. And then when people just immediately... I think certain people who don't necessarily have that kind of abstract thought in terms of film comparison, like, goes back to what I was saying before. Like, if something's not identical, it's like, what? This doesn't look like. And it's like, it doesn't have to be identical. But you get it. You're just trying to be difficult on purpose. So I think that's what a lot of people are, you know?
Right. Like, I think it's really interesting that Claire Denis is one of your favorite filmmakers, because I think you sort of have to have that kind of abstract thinking just to be able to watch one of her movies on its own, because there are these big ellipses where you have to connect two images to fill in parts of the story or the relationships that aren't explained in a more conventional narrative sense. So I was wondering if maybe your brain has to be wired a certain way to be able to watch films like that and then make those sorts of connections between films.
I agree. She's the queen, she's the queen of hints and implications is always how I like to describe her films a lot. Like, when I find myself writing about her movies, I always go back to that term, like, hints and implications, rather than, like, something being spelled out. It's like, you see a lot, oftentimes in her movies, like, you see someone's old picture, like, in a picture frame, then later on down the line, it's like, oh, that was, you know, Nanette and Bonnie's mother, or someone's, you know, in 35 Shots of Rum, the daughter's reading a letter, and then you realize, oh, she's reading a letter, a love letter that her mother wrote to her father, you know, before she passed away. Like, it's just kind of, you know, it's that kind of stuff. So, but it goes, but I was asked, you know, it's, oh man, what podcast was I on? Oh, it was on Bradley Cornish. We did a part one talking about Blue Velvet and David Lynch.
Right.
And he was asking me about the side-by-side comparison. And I still am. Like, I come from a DJ background, which is essentially mixing two songs together so that they blend together. And he asked me about that. And then I didn't realize. I was like, oh, maybe that's how my brain is wired. And that's kind of why you take two records, one on, you know, on each end, and then you have to mix two pieces of music together so that they're both on beat at the same time, which essentially is a form of side-by-side comparison just in terms of movies. And you know, in anything I do, any, you know, the few things that I take great interest in, I'm just big on history. Not all the time, but I think definitely more than half side-by-side movie comparisons are, it is a form of history, because you see where this movie comes from. Like, you know, like, let's just kind of do, as my friend Chris Funderburg likes to say, low-hanging fruit. Like, if you take Pulp Fiction, like, that movie is just, all of his movies are, but Pulp Fiction specifically, Kill Bill also, it's just filled with references, one reference after another. Some people get, some people don't. So, and it's, if you love, I think if you love something too, it's kind of, it doesn't hurt to know where something came from, like, to know its origin. And I think Pulp Fiction is a perfect example. It's just like, it's totally like Quentin Tarantino and most of his movies, just saying, hey, check out my video collection, or check out how many movies I've seen, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you sort of mentioned low hanging fruit. I remember maybe 2 months ago, you had a post where you sort of suggested that you might block or unfollow people on Twitter who had side by side cliches, because there are some that you see repeated over and over again.
No, totally. And someone actually, since then, two people have been blocked, because I guess they thought I was joking, but I was not. So,
I remember one of them was the Shining twins and Diane Arbus twins photograph, because I think Chris Funderburg actually posted that just to tease you right after.
Yeah, that's how he likes to do.
But that's one you see very often. You've seen them repeated so many times, or the filmmakers themselves have drawn so much attention on a particular reference that it's not really surprising or it's not really interesting to point out over and over again that, hey, that's where this comes from. It's sort of just accepted. That's, you know, that's where the briefcase in Pulp Fiction comes from.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. No, and also because I love Deanne Arbus and I love Stanley Kubrick. But mm-hmm. it's just that image has right. just been done, you know, so many times. Oh, yeah, no, I have it right here. Just like, so for example, besides The Shining, Deanne Arbus, it was like, again, here's another one, Tarkovsky and von Trier, because those are two filmmakers that anyone right. who knows me just a little bit knows I love them too. Mm-hmm. Tarkovsky and Malick, I think I said that one I said more of an arrogant way because I like to think I drained. Or like Venus de Milo, Dreamers, you know, with mm-hmm. What is her name? What is that actress's name? She was in James Bond. Oh, she's drawn Ava Green. Yep. Yeah, her coming out with the, you know, she's wearing the black arm gloves and it blends into the dark Venus de Milo. Or like The Birth of Venus and Uma Thurman and Baron Munchausen. It's just things like that. It's just kind of like, you know, come on. Or even, I think the main one I put was, it's not so much... Like, you did a thing with Solaris and that... What is that original movie? What's that science fiction movie
Ikari XB-1.
Yeah, like that. Like, there's... Yeah. Like, you know, that's okay. But when it gets to certain things like shot for shot, like the original and the remake, it's almost like... There's a cool way to do that stuff, but when you just take, like, you know, Psycho and Gus Van Sant's Psycho, it's like you're not proving anything because Gus, that was an intentionally shot for shot remake, or like the Funny Games thing, like, yeah, it's cool on the surface, but that was a shot for shot remake.
Like, sometimes I mean, I'm probably more guilty of that.
No, not compared to what I see.
You know, I have done comparisons between the Tarkovsky Solaris and the Soderbergh Solaris, and
but that's different though, like, but that's what
for
I'm
me,
getting
though,
into
it's more interested in, you know, what separates them as filmmakers versus what's similar, because like Soderbergh's not trying to necessarily recreate it, but he's not working as if the Tarkovsky film doesn't exist either in adapting the book. So it's interesting to see how that balance is struck.
And that's what I was getting into, because sure, that Solaris is technically a remake, but it's like, you know, we're talking a 3-hour version versus a 90-minute version one. There's a lot of stuff left out of Soderbergh Solaris intentionally. So that's what I'm saying. Like, those are the kind of remakes where it's in, because I did that myself. That was an old Pinland Empire post where I wrote about Soderbergh Solaris and compared some shots to Tarkovsky, because for a remake, it takes a lot of liberties. So it's interesting to see comparisons between those kinds of remakes. Like, I like to, I described Soderbergh Solaris as, and I'm sure, you know, like, you must have friends who aren't, you know, cinephiles and movie lovers like you, but you want them to like this movie. And it's like, and that's how, Soderbergh, to me, Soderbergh is definitely a cinephile. So Soderbergh probably, like, he has friends, like, you can't recommend the Tarkovsky Solaris to, like, your buddy who likes, you know, football or stuff like that, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. So he tried to make a more accessible version. At the end of the day, I guess it didn't work. I mean, I love that movie, but generally speaking, that movie was, you know, it's a failure. But I respect the fact that, like, he clearly just loved the movie so much and just wanted to make a version for, like, non-snobby, artsy movie lovers to, you know, enjoy. It's a very beautiful movie, just down to, from the score to, like, the editing. It was during that period, it was on the back end of that, like, out of sight, limey, kind of like really choppy yet beautiful editing style that he was doing, where, you know, audio from one scene was overlapping, you know, into another scene, and then right away you'd get a flashback scene. It was that was a great period for Soderbergh, I think, between, like, basically 98 through 2002.
And he's also somebody who, you know, he'd go and he'd recut 2001 to make it faster paced, or mm-hmm. he'd, you know, as an experiment, recut Raiders of the Lost Ark. I sort of wonder, like, not just being a cinephile, but there's sort of a special kind of relationship where you want to be hands-on with certain films. I don't know how much of it comes from just, you know, living through the age of home video, where you own a film, you can pause it, you can rewind it, you can even, especially with, like, DVDs, you can download it, recut it. You know, I'm always sort of fascinated by fan films. I think there's something, like, I think, you know, your comparison to the DJing, like, it's very similar, where you can be more hands-on with the film. You're not just a passive person in a movie theater. So it's maybe a little bit of a different relationship with films that, you know, produces somebody like Soderbergh. You know, I always feel like most films I've seen weren't in a theater. They were on VHS tape or DVD. That's how I've experienced most films. So I don't know if I necessarily watch them the same way that people... Mm-hmm.
No, I wanted to just jump in real quick too and say, because yeah, there was that period over the last couple of years, you know, Steven Soderbergh recutting movies is like kind of this cool thing. It gets a lot of press, but I always have to make this, I always have to say, like, the first movie he did was of his friend, Steven Soderbergh's buddy, Lodge Kerrigan. Did you ever see Keen? With Damian Lewis. It's a great, but on that, and that, but that movie came out in 2004. The DVD came out in 2005, and Soderbergh does the director's commentary with Lodge Kerrigan. And there's on the special features, there's a whole other movie of Keen where it's recut. It's Steven Soderbergh recut it. So that was like his first movie, but it wasn't as advertised. And again, you know, Keen isn't Raiders of the Lost Ark or anything like that. But that's such a great example because, The version he recut, it's just a totally different, you know. So I just always like saying that because a lot of people think, like, since, you know, 2014 or something, Steven Soderbergh started doing it. Right. But nah, he's been doing it well long, you know, before then. But, you know, whatever. Just had to say that.
Well, I think, like, even going back to, like, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, there's definitely, like, a sort of fascination with video and accumulating footage and how it's presented. Like,
sure. Films.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I mean, some filmmakers, they're almost... outside of that, like, I remember watching Mabete's Tuki Buki and Hyenas, like, trying to find side-by-sides, and, like, I, you know, was coming up completely short, and it wasn't because, like, there weren't these incredible, startling images, it's just, like, I couldn't connect it to anything. And then later on, I read in an interview where he said, yeah, I don't really watch that many movies, I don't really... I'm not really that interested in other films. I'm just interested in my own films. And, like, I could completely believe that. I know some filmmakers do kind of try to downplay their influences. Like, sometimes you hear a David Lynch talk, and he almost... I don't know if there's, like, a little bit of an embarrassment to admit that we're... that filmmakers are influenced by other films. But, like, I know some filmmakers say, like, oh, I've never heard of that. Or, like, I don't know. I don't really watch too many movies. But then you can see it in their movies. You know?
Yeah. No, I like the whole Jim Jarmusch has never seen Star Wars. I feel like that's, I don't know. He seems like a stand up guy, but that just seems like either he's lying, one, or he just wants to seem cool. I've never seen Star Wars. All right, good for you. You know, I hate insulting one of my, like, but, I mean, throwing shots at one of my Star Wars filmmakers. Like, you still know the references. It's one of those movies you don't have to see it to know what like, you know what an Ewok is, like, you know what Endor is, you know what a Wookiee is, like, right. You know who Lando Calrissian is. It's just one of those movies.
You could probably just look at all the, like, clips you've seen on TV or from different things, and, like, you've probably seen the whole film, just not all at once.
Even if you hasn't
sat down and watched it, you know, it's impossible to escape images from something like that. You know, earlier you talked about Xavier Dolan not necessarily realizing he was referencing certain things that, like, he hadn't watched, but I think there's, like, sort of a vicarious influence going on in a lot of cases where a filmmaker is maybe not directly influenced by a particular filmmaker, but you see they're influenced by somebody who is influenced by them, you know. So somebody who's maybe drawing on somebody like Lars von Trier, for instance, doesn't realize that they're also drawing on Tarkovsky.
And 1,000%, absolutely.
All of film history, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's a huge cinephile. But to go back to what you're saying, though, a director, like someone who would make a film like Tuki Buki, I totally believe that they haven't seen a lot of movies just because of, like, from the conditions of maybe their country to just, like, technology. Like, there is a really good chance. And I a lot of times find that stuff commendable, where it's just, like, it's cool sometimes to have no references and then make something.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, sometimes there's coincidences, and other times it's like if you look at a guy like Timothy Carey, who did, you know, World's Greatest Sinner, I guess a lot of people would know him more from, he was in, you know, John Cassavetes' film. He was in Kubrick's films, too. God, he was in, you know, he was in Paths of Glory. He was the assassin in The Killing. But as a filmmaker, his films were pretty original. His son did a retrospective of his work at this theater in New York City at Anthology Film Archives. And Timothy Carey's son was saying, you know, like, my dad really tried to avoid watching things because he wanted, when he wanted to direct and make his own films, he wanted to be as uninfluenced as possible. It's impossible to you're always going to be influenced by something, but he wanted to keep his influences at a minimum and just try to be as original as possible.
Right.
I don't think you can ever be fully original, but, you know.
No. I mean, sometimes, like, going back and watching very early silent films, I sort of expect them to be completely pristine in their images, and you kind of realize, like, no, they're drawing on pre-film popular images. Like, I remember watching the 1912 version of Quo Vadis, and there's a scene with the gladiators in the pit, and it's just like the famous painting.
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
Felice Verso, yep. You know, and it's like, of course, like, you know, we live on popular images and we sort of are influenced by them. We can't really escape them. It doesn't matter if they come from paintings or films.
Absolutely.
You know, they feed into just how we communicate visually.
Yeah. Which I found. Yeah, I think it's kind of cool. I mean, not every post I appreciate, but I do like the whole art into film account. I really like what they're doing. It's just one of those things. I just don't feel like being petty on social media, but there's like 4, 5, 6-year-old video montages that people took the time to put together that, like, people kind of, I guess, pass off as their own, because it's one of those things where, like, I've seen this, that there's a Vimeo channel of this guy who does these, and he did this years ago, so at least give that guy credit. You know, I know that sounds petty to some people, but it's like, you know, you put all this time into watching movies and getting that perfect screen grab and all that stuff, just at least say, hey, I got this from so-and-so. Don't try to pass it off as your own, which happens from time to time. So
I mean, sometimes it's weird because, like, I've had people, like, after I posted, like, a side-by-side or posted some interesting image on Twitter, I've had people, like, obviously drag it under their desktop and then repost it without naming me or anything like that.
Yeah, that's really annoying.
Like, I almost feel like I can't say anything because, like, well, like, I didn't create the images. Like, you know, you could have gone out and found them yourselves. So, like, I don't really have any ownership over them, but at the same time, it's really annoying. So,
no, like, but to go back, you're right. Like, you didn't shoot the movies, but it's like you still took the time, the mental, whatever. Like, you still watched those movies enough to know
it's
that,
like, they stole my observation. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which it's still annoying. That's still messed up. So yeah, I've had to block a couple of people who did what you said. Like, it wouldn't even be like similar image. It was literally what I posted, and they just passed it off on their own. And then eventually I had to block them.
And you know, because you have to go through, like, sometimes frame by frame to find exactly the right one that lines
absolutely
up as best as possible.
Absolutely, going slow motion, think, bringing, like, it back. All
does
that.
Does it maybe by taking those frames, do you sometimes lose the context of the whole film? You know, even sometimes when you have video pieces, I've seen comparing two video clips from two different films, I feel like, okay, I get that they're similar, but it kind of takes them out of context in a way that I think maybe it's on purpose to make them look more similar than.
Sure.
You know,
I'm definitely guilty of that.
I've even seen, like, in some cases, like, people taking instead of a still from The Exorcist, a black and white production photo and putting it next to a dryer film. Like, of course,
oh,
it's going to make it look more like they're similar, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know if it's, like, you know, like, I can't call it cheating because it's not a game.
No, it is. I think cheating is a good
word.
It's
a little bit deceptive, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm guilty. I'm obviously. I mean, you can only, I mean, you do, like, hundreds and thousands, like, you're obviously gonna be like, no, I want this to work, damn it. So you just kind of force it. But I try to keep that at a minimum, because even I don't do video editing, but I try to do, like, when I do these panels of, like, 5 against 5 or 6 against 6, it's not even so much that there's a similar thing, but it's just like the way they're the context of the scene that I'm showing is similar too. So I know what you mean, but I try to even keep the whole tone and you know, and the whole vibe of that similar. Like, I put, like, here's another good example of me getting trashed on Facebook, but then the complete opposite on Twitter. When the first Dunkirk trailer came out, I compared some images from Dunkirk to Thin Red Line, and then this one guy on Twitter liked it so much that he made a video side by side of it. And gave me credit too, which was very nice. He didn't have to do that. But then on Twitter, again, it was just like, this is not even the same thing. But it's like the shot in Dunkirk of, like, where they're all, you know, it's a kind of semi overhead and you could see the top of everyone's helmet. And then there's this kind of oncoming sound that's just like in the Thin Red Line where it's this kind of overhead shot. You see the top of everyone's helmets. And then there's, like, this impeding doom. Like, it's shot the same.
Well, I mean, that's a good one because, like, Nolan is also somebody who said that, you know, he's tried to draw inspiration from Malick. And, like, I think that's a good example too, because the side by side, it's it almost becomes like that's not the end product, that's the starting point. Because I know now, like, after seeing something like that when I go and see Dunkirk, I'm going to be thinking about it in context of, okay, does this draw on the Thin Red Line maybe in other ways, and maybe trying to connect it through that film lineage, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I also like to, and obviously I don't do this all the time, but like I've got, you know, like 7 years worth of content now on my site. So when I do, half the time when I post a side-by-side comparison, I put a link to something I've written. So it's not just like, hey, look at these pretty images. Like, no, I actually wrote stuff too that maybe can give you a little bit more context. You know, like when you take, there's the elevator scene in Sunnytean where there's like a shootout on the elevator versus like the scene in Drive where like they kiss and then Gosling just, you know, smashes the guy's face in. Like, it's different types of violence. They're shot kind of differently, but the overall execution, it's like both scenes where it's like it's completely silent on an elevator and suddenly boom, there's an explosion of violence in not so much tight quarters, but literally in an elevator. Like that, like you can't say that Refn, you know, didn't see that movie and wasn't right. Influenced by that.
That's a side-by-side comparison that it's trying to get across, not just a similarity of composition or color or things like that. It's trying to reflect the tone or the vibe of a film, that it's something a little bit more elusive when you're trying to describe why certain films are similar. But, you know, you're absolutely right about the quietness punctuated by that extreme violence. You know, sometimes it's hard to explain like why I think one film is similar to another film. You know, there's times I'm like, oh, that reminds me a lot of this film, and you know, you just get the blank stares, like you're
yeah.
nuts.
Oh yeah.
Even comparing those two, but you know, so it helps to have like the kind of visual comparisons to sort of illustrate that. Do you think some comparisons are a little bit of a stretch, or
sure,
you know, is there
sure
is there sacred ground? You know,
I don't know if about. I mean, I compared. You know, I'm not a religious person, but it's like, you know, I compared the image of, you know, the death of Jesus to, you know, the scene in Rocky IV of Rocky Balboa holding Apollo Creed. So clearly, so nothing's sacred.
Perfect example. Yeah.
So nothing is sacred. But yeah, no, a lot of, because sometimes, like, you just, like, this just looks cool and I'm going to post it. Like, I'm sure this one, neither director of these movies are aware of each other's films, but hey, it looks cool. Like, you know, it's better than, and I don't mean to, like, sure. downplay someone else, but, like, when you just post, like, just like a generic image from a movie, it's like, oh, but like I'm putting two cool images next to each other, you know, it doesn't hurt. It's not hurting anything. Or like, and I have plenty, I do this myself, but like if you post like a behind the scenes thing, it's just like, how many times do you need to see, like, you know, Harrison Ford and Steven Spielberg hanging out on set versus like, look at these two right. cool polarizing images that may or may not have a connection, but they look cool next to each other, you know? So
The times when I've gotten kind of pretty harsh feedback, it's usually when I compare something that's maybe regarded as a classic versus something that doesn't have that strong of a reputation,
or of course, of course, considered
very highbrow, or to something that's very lowbrow. People, you know, they don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or even just like comparing filmmakers who, you know, maybe worked in different genres, people seem to get upset by, as if, like, you know, these things have to be hermetically sealed within the traditional ways that we classify them.
Sure, sure.
I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with comparing a horror film with a, you know, classic drama, if you see maybe it's drawing on it, because it's not like it's totally incestuous where you have horror films just drawing on other horror films, or
no,
dramas just drawing on other dramas. I think film, it's bigger than that, you know.
No, it's true. But to go back to you saying like how you discovered the thing I did, like the series I did, School of Tarkovsky, which I'm working on part six right now. FYI, the only reason I did that was because I read books on filmmakers and I read interviews, and I did that because it was one by one. Mm-hmm. Carlos Regattas has no shame in citing Tarkovsky. You know, Lars von Trier has right. no shame in citing. He even did it like the School of Tarkovsky part one that I did, it starts off by saying it's the still from the opening credits of Melancholia when Lars von Trier says, dedicated to, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky. I was at a Q&A. Obviously, Lars von Trier wasn't there in person because he doesn't come to the States, but it was like a Skype chat on a big screen. And he said in the Q&A, in his earlier days, he wanted to be Tarkovsky. He wanted his films to be like Tarkovsky. Right. So Alexander Sakharov, who they actually used to work together. You know what I mean? Like, they were they were friends. So, like, these are examples of stuff where it's like, I'm not just pulling things out of my ass. I think if people, it just come, and I'm not saying I expect, but like, I feel like when people are so vocal in their negativity or skepticism, I think if you, instead of taking the time to be negative and cynical about like, oh, look, two shots of a tunnel, it's kind of like, if you read interviews, books, and listen to director's commentary, you'll find like the deeper connection there, that it's not just like, oh, two things look the same. There's a lot more depth.
I don't know if you've ever had filmmakers sort of confirm side-by-sides or comparisons you've made, or if there's ever been any instances where you've kind of had some confirmation of something that you've suspected, where, you know, you've thought maybe there's an influence here, and then you can say, okay, I'm pretty sure now there's an influence here.
One example, I'll get to that in a second. Usually, like, especially if one filmmaker's on Twitter, I'm always hesitant, because going back to what I was saying earlier, I'm all, you know, directors don't want to be seen as copycats or anything like that. But I've had 100% success rate of like a filmmaker or an actor or actress seeing something and going, oh, wow, this is really cool. Because I'm always worried, like, oh, what do you think? I'm unoriginal. I'm a copycat. Like Rebecca C. Hall saw the comparison I did of Nightcrawler and her recent movie Christine, and she was just she was like flattered, like, oh wow, this is really cool. Or like Barry Jenkins saw the comparison I did. He saw a couple. I did a couple. There was a comparison I did of Moonlight and Gus Van Sant, and like he retweeted it. It was like, oh, I love this, and it was kind of like, phew, because it's like easy to right. Like with no words, it's easy to be like, oh, look, he totally stole this, but he got what I was doing, so thank God. I will say the one kind of confirmation was, I remember when I was a teenager, or like in my early 20s. This is going back to, you know, Lodge Kerrigan. Have you seen the film Clean Shaven?
Yeah, Clean Shaven.
So he talked about Roman Polanski so much which is fine. Like that's probably one of Lodge's favorite filmmakers. He talked about it so much, and then the first time like we met in person and we hung out, it was just like he was talking about The Tenant nonstop. Like, you know, like not the whole night, but there was this one, you know, where the movie people at this party got into their movie talk, and it's like Lodge Kerrigan, who cites Roman Polanski a lot, next thing you know, we're talking about The Tenant for like well over an hour, you know, and it's kind of like, okay, that confirms that. And then just little things were like, he references Polanski, I think, in the Keen director's commentary too, but then there's that scene in Keen where he's like digging his nail in, and then like the way the camera zooms in, it's so much so similar to the scene in Repulsion where Catherine Deneuve is working on that woman's nail, and then like the camera zooms in and then she pricks too far, and then it's like it's you know, like, you know, you can't really it's one of those things where like where you get it's like an unfinished math equation where like, you know, all the parts are there, just the such and such equals, and they just didn't answer the question. It's like everything is there that would just like, you know, it's like 2 + 2 + 2, you know, +3 equals 9, but it's just like no one wrote 9. So all the stuff is there, you know, as far as I'm concerned. Right. So I guess that's kind of the one, you know, somewhat confirmation. Otherwise, it's just been people who were appreciative and they never said like, oh, this did influence me, this didn't. There are some filmmakers who I'd love to kind of like get a handle on, but I doubt. But they seem like a Claire Denis. I wanted to know if she was influenced by this. But as much as I love her films and her, she seems to be like she'd be a little elusive. Like, oh, I've never seen that. When it's like, yes, you have, or something. You know, just kind of one of those right. things. It's like, yeah.
Oh, one of my favorites was I made a comparison between a Henry Georges Clouzot film and.
Punisher Warzone, episode. And Lexi Alexander saw it.
I liked your comment, though. She was like, yeah, I copy Class.
Yeah, I only copy Class. I remember. That was awesome.
That was a good one, because, I mean, it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but that film's gorgeous for anyone who's seen it.
Yeah. I saw that in the theater, actually.
Me too. I had a great time watching that in the theater. So yeah. I know they said it didn't make much money, but it's not my fault.
Sure.
I did my part.
Yeah, same here.
Or I remember, like, I sort of, I, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the same as if like George Miller had retweeted it, but I did a comparison between Sorcerer and Mad Max Fury Road when they have the blue light and the truck, the big truck is on the winch and it's attached to the tree and it's kind of breaking. Like, I compared those two because like, I did kind of think that's probably where George Miller got it from. And William Friedkin retweeted that. I don't know. Like, it wasn't really like an endorsement or anything, but it was sort of my way of thinking like, oh yeah, they, like he probably does think that he took it from him, you know?
Okay. Well, you know, okay. Well then you just remind me. Yeah. William Friedkin, he's for such like an older guy. He's when it comes to like social media, especially Twitter, he's on
very
it.
Active on Twitter.
So I guess those are my kind of confirmations. He's totally a guy who I could see getting offended at something. Like just the other day I compared this, it was like a Francis Bacon image with The Exorcist. I tagged him in it, hoping he wouldn't take offense to it, and then, you know, he retweeted it. I do sometimes ask him questions alongside, like I did, it was the image of, you know, Max von Sydow, you know, making the woman float in the Bergman film, The Magician, and then next to Max von Sydow in, you know, The Exorcist, he's standing by the bed with Reagan floating, right. And it's like, that, I mean, come on, and you know, I didn't really need it, I didn't say anything, but he retweeted. I feel like anytime William Friedkin retweets, like, one of my side-by-sides involving his movies, that's just kind of him saying, like, either this is cool, or yep, you got it, you know what I mean?
I mean, he's also somebody who's, like, a little bit more involved with the film culture, like, I think he always has been, and he's somebody who would go and interview Fritz Lang, and he was... Even the casting of Max von Sydow in The Exorcist is sort of like an homage to Bergman. You know, like sometimes, like I think it's interesting the way that an actor or actress popping up in another film might be a sign of a filmmaker being influenced by another. Like, I thought it was interesting going between like Paul Verhoeven and David Lynch, who like don't overtly seem that similar, but I think like, you know, seeing some of the cast pass back and forth, Miguel Ferrer, who passed away recently, going from RoboCop to
Twin Peaks,
and then you have Kyle MacLachlan showing up in Showgirls, and then you have
I didn't think about that.
Lena Riffle showing up in Mulholland Drive, and then like it sort of made me think like, oh yeah, Mulholland Drive's also this sort of like showbiz world with the lesbian plot, and it like it's sort of making me like look for more similarities, and I'm like, I bet Lynch likes Showgirls, you know?
That's a really good point.
Kind of, like sometimes the casting kind of tips me off to certain things, like, you know, there's certain actors, not that you're like, oh, why else would they cast them, but like, you know, there's times where I'm blanking on her name, the actress who played the girl in Days of Heaven,
Linda Manns.
Like Linda Manns, like I think, yeah. You know, you sort of pointed out to me before, like her showing up in Gummo, like that is sort of Harmony Korine, like if not like an homage, that's, you know, possibly him just like wanting to work somebody who worked with Malick and maybe try and pick up some of
that. No, I said Badlands and Days of Heaven are two of his, are in his all-time top 10. So a movie like Days of Heaven, you know, obviously like Linda Manns, that's like his kind of like archival, you know, thing. I also want to say it's also so random how Linda Manns shows up in The Game, the David Fincher film. You know, like there's that one scene where that's so random. I don't think that's an homage. I wouldn't be surprised if...
I don't know if it's like, oh, can we get her here for one day just to like, you know, it's like a free Q&A with somebody who worked on Days of Heaven. Like, you know, who knows if it was just like, okay, we can get her in the film. And that way, like, you know, I'll get like 30 minutes or an hour to just be like, hey, how did Terrence Malick do this? Because I think like I've seen, there was like a video a while ago of, I think maybe it was even posted on Criterion's website where it was like David Fincher and Christopher Nolan doing an appreciation of Terrence Malick, which I thought was really weird because those are two guys who like, for me, don't immediately come to mind when I think of Terrence Malick. And definitely like, I still don't even see them. Like, I think even when like Christopher Nolan's like trying to draw on his stuff for something like Interstellar, like it feels kind of forced or it doesn't really, you know, it's like, again, like it's sort of the opposite where, you know, you can put Jessica Chastain in your movie and you can shoot Wheatfields. It doesn't make you Malick, you know?
I mean, they both work with some of the same actors. I mean, Brad Pitt and Christian Bale have both worked with Malick, and they've worked with, you know, Fincher and Nolan. But also, you know, my favorite example of that is Lars von Trier's Europa. He's a big, big, big Fassbender guy, self-admittedly. So, like, half the cast in Europa. It's made up of like Barbara Sukowa. I'm hoping I say her name right. Udo Kier, Eddie Constantine, all key, you know, Fassbender players. And even, you know, he's also he's a Bergman guy. So to have Max von Sydow, you know, narrate Europa, also it's kind of like narration. You know, yeah. I'm trying to think. There's got to be some other, like, I guess, you know, whatever. Tarantino's kind of the king of that too, like casting, you know, older.
Well, I mean, Tarantino with the casting, like, again, you know, casting Pam Grier, for instance, in Jackie Brown, like, you know, that the casting itself works as kind of an homage, and then the film itself is sort of playing on her. Yeah.
She was actually
history as an actress, you know.
She was actually supposed to be Rosanna Arquette's character in Pulp Fiction. And, like, she was cast for it and everything. And then Quentin Tarantino, at the last minute, he was kind of like, I don't know, Eric Stoltz and Pam Grier don't seem like they would be a couple. Furthermore, Eric Stoltz doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would, like, yell and fuss at Pam Grier and she would accept it. So that was part of his motivation for doing Jackie Brown. It was just like, oh, I said you'd be in this movie, but I'm, you know, but I'll make it up to you. So that's why, you know, he ended up doing Jackie Brown.
I think that's also something similar happened with Sid Haig, because I think Sid Haig, who acted with Pam Grier in a bunch of old Jack Hale films, he was supposed to play Marcellus Wallace, and then that didn't work out for some reason, and so he got cast as the judge in Jackie Brown. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
But, like, I think there is, like, a kind of homage that is very forced and awkward, and, like, usually that's, like, kind of, like, again, the low-hanging fruit, the easy side-by-sides to make, the comparisons to make. You know, if you go to any kind of end-of-the-year student film screenings, it's just, like, loaded with, like, oh, you know, that kid really wants to be Martin Scorsese. That one really wants to be Kubrick. That one really wants to be, you know, whoever.
Sure.
It's like, I think there's a real art to turning some aspect of another filmmaker into a part of your own vision.
Or another great example of, like, a guy like Hal Hartley kind of taking that Bressonian approach of, like, line delivery, like that kind of monotone, I don't want to say lifeless, but whatever. It's the Hal Hartley style of acting and the Bresson style of acting, but taking that kind of Bresson style and, like, bringing it to, like, working class, you know, Long Island, New York, or, like, you know, Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Like, there's, like, Hal Hartley is definitely influenced by Bresson, but at the same time, he makes his own movies. Like, Bresson would never, plot-wise, Bresson would never make a Hal Hartley film, and Hal Hartley would never really make a Bresson film. But there's little, you know, tips of the hat, rather, you know. And just like you're saying, I think, like, he takes that, I mean, because Bresson totally represents, like, that art house. He's like he's probably the most, one of the three most influential art house filmmakers, and he brings him into, like, you know, like take the world of, like, Henry Fool, like drunken degenerates who, you know, get drunk and go to strip clubs and stuff like that. Like, there'd never be strip clubs. There would never be, like, raunchy sex scenes in, like, a Robert Bresson movie, whereas, like, in certain Hal Hartley films, you'll see that. So, yeah, I like that.
What kind of gets me, like, I don't know, sometimes it feels like the circle I'm in, group I find myself in, like, Hal Hartley's not a very popular filmmaker, and one thing I hear a lot is, like, oh, the acting in his movies is bad. I'm like, first of all, you know all those actors, like, you know they're not bad actors. Second of all, like, you would never say that about a Bresson film, even though it's, like, basically the same sort of affectation.
And they're non-professional. Sort of they're non-professional style, you know? Actors. They're non-professional right. actors, whereas, like, exactly, just like what you said, it's like, you take Hal Hartley films, like, we all know Edie Falco. We know her from The Sopranos, we know her from Oz, and it's like, so to see her in Unbelievable Truth or Trust, or, like, you know, look at a guy like Martin Donovan or someone like that, or, like, so many people, like Robert John Burke and Bill Sage being, like, Law and Order regulars, or, like, just other movies, you know, that they've been in, and to see them in how, like, you know, you gotta, you know, exactly, you know, it's like you said, like, it's not bad acting, you know, I it's funny, because that's when the first Hal Hartley film I saw when I saw Simple Men for the first time, I was a little kid, and I was just like, why are they acting like, is this, like, bad acting? But even though I remember it, like, this can't be on purpose, like, there's a reason for this, but, you know, an 11-year-old brain can't comprehend, you know, that, but I still wasn't, oh, this is dumb, this is bad, it's just like, it was like, this is weird, something's not right, but I think it's intentional, so, I don't know, yeah.
I mean, I had the same thing watching, like, some of David Lynch's films, like, it just kind of makes me, like, uncomfortable, the performance style in some of them, which, like, I always appreciated and thought was a good thing. I never thought of it as, like, bad acting. It's just, it's going for a specific effect. I think like a lot of people, anything that's not aligned, it's not even like realistic acting. It's just like that kind of Hollywood idea of naturalism.
Yeah.
Like anything that sort of deviates from that, people like to say, oh, that's bad.
Yep.
You know, because it's different. So, but like, again, you have these art house titans like Bresson who had acting styles that are like quite different from that, that people, you know, they won't say a bad word. But again, like just going back to the visual stuff, like sometimes it's frustrating when, you know, you post two side by sides and it's like not even just of the same shot, but like a whole sequence. You know, I'll post a series of stills that are just like sort of selected from like two sequences, which are basically identical.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will be like, okay, the film on the left is like horrible. The film on the right's great. Like, how dare you compare these two? Even mm-hmm. though like it's basically the same thing that you're watching in both.
And yeah. No, I agree. And yeah, it's almost a pointless statement. Like, yeah, I've had that a couple of times. What I do recently, it was like Bergman and like Donnie Darko, and it was just like, here's an example of a great film versus a piece of shit. And it's like, all right, I'm not trying to say one is. I don't know if I care about either movie, but right. just visually, like it's you know, it looks similar, and you're just seeing influence. One filmmaker rub off on another, or possibly rub off on another. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So it's not about putting two films on the same platform either, or the same pedestal.
But I think it is like revealing sometimes when you show a film that's, you know, maybe very respected, and a film that doesn't necessarily have that appreciation yet, or sometimes is even hated, and like. You know, okay, if like they're so different in quality, if they're so different in how we respond to them, like, can we pinpoint in the specific images, like, what's so different about these?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, is there a difference even if it's just like external factors? I'm not always sure.
And, you know, at the end of the day, I should have said this earlier. You also never know who likes what. I went to go see Louis C.K. speak. Mm-hmm. It wasn't to do stand-up. This is when his stand-up special, Hilarious, this was like 2010. And then at the Q&A, I asked him, and I prefaced it by saying, normally this is such a generic kind of hack question, but you know, I'm interested to know what films you like and what, you know, and then like, so right away, some of the first stuff that he said, you know, was diabolique, you know, and he even said Henry George Clouseau by name, and then he said Barry Lyndon, which this movie I think is a little overrated. But still, this like raunchy kind of like stand-up comic who's responsible for Pootie Tang
right.
knows who Henry George Clouseau is by name. So like that right there, it's like you never know who watches what, you know, kind of like you. It almost goes to like if you take it outside of film, like you hear stories of a lot of like classical music conductors on their off time. They like to listen to jazz or rock and roll. Like they don't like to be around the music that they, mm-hmm. you know, or just like a lot of rappers, a lot of hip-hop artists
sure.
don't listen to other rap. Like they like to listen to, you know, soul or something like that to just and in one sense, you know, it keeps you fresh to just kind of like, oh, I'm not around the same stuff that I do, so I'm not gonna, you know, get caught up in subconsciously copy, you know, or something like that, you know. So
well, I remember like I think it was Roger Corman posted his top 10 films list,
mm-hmm.
and you know, not only just listed them, but wrote like a little paragraph about each one and talked about them quite eloquently. So, you know, he's not just talking out of his ass, listing
yeah,
things. And
yeah.
he did like stuff like Bergman and, you know, very like classy stuff. So like, it might sound absurd if I'm going to compare maybe a Bergman film to a 1960s Roger Corman film, but he saw them, he knows about them, he can talk about them eloquently. Like all of a sudden the comparison doesn't become that much of a stretch, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
Or if you see something, it's maybe like less likely that you're just looking for random combinations that align at a certain point. I mean, it's also, there's a whole thing, like not even just coincidence, but I feel like there's only so many ways you can represent certain ideas or certain images
of course,
on film.
Of course.
There's an effective way to express it. It's almost like over time filmmakers kind of engineer and work out what's effective or what's ineffective, and then there's like a certain way that you represent something on film.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
I mean, some of the best side-by-sides who aren't necessarily two different filmmakers' films, but films that are all part of a filmmaker's body of work, or even sometimes within a single film, you sort of highlight a specific motif that you know, might not have been aware of before.
No, agree. And like, okay, so here's a great example. Going back to Claire Denis, if you look at Chocolat, just from the way it looks, you would think that Chocolat and I don't know, like Bastards, were made by completely, different people. Or, like, there's a grittiness to Claire Denis' second and third film, No Fear, No Die and I Can't Sleep. You know, it's about, like, No Fear, No Die, it's about underground cockfighting, and I Can't Sleep, part of it's about a guy who kills, old women, whereas, like, something like White Material, forget White Material, but, like, Claire Denis' surreal period, where she made, like, The Intruder or Friday Night, you would think, obviously, she uses a lot of the same actors, but if you're willing to look past that, just from the look, ambiance, and vibe, it's like, oh, this is a totally different person. But then when you just dig a little deeper, it's like, oh, it's a lot of the same elements, a lot of the same motifs. And I find that really cool how, like, you can still grow and evolve as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. but there's still, like, that common thread since day one. You still do the same stuff. Because at the end of the day, it's you have to do something that makes you, that makes all of your films yours. So I do like that her movies right. looked... It's not just Claire Denis. She's obviously not the only person. I mean, Lars von Trier is another person. Like, the element of crime looks completely different than Idiots. You know what I mean? But then there's still... When you dig a little deeper, you'll find a lot of similarities. And I like that, where you can still grow, but still maintain things that make your films yours. Because I'm very much... I like when filmmakers can grow, but I also like when they stick to what they're good at, too. And that applies to a lot of stuff, whether it's artists, musicians. Yeah.
That adds a lot of credence to the auteur theory, I think. I think it's like the term's been a little bit co-opted, where, like, now for certain people, what auteur means is somebody who writes and directs and does the music and does the editing and, like, has total control over the film, because we sort of say, oh, well, it's like a group effort, there's many factors, there's many different people working on it. So, like, I think for people to feel like a filmmaker's an auteur, they have to say they have as much control over a film as possible. But, like, really, the way it started was that a filmmaker didn't have to write it, they didn't have to do anything, just directing it itself was enough to have a huge creative impact on the film. And, like, I know in film school, like, they'll have assignments where you have to even sometimes with the same crew, same actors, shoot the same script, and you can have 9 or 10 different film students direct with the same people, same script, and each one's going to turn out wildly differently. Mm-hmm. And you're probably going to see a little bit of each person's personality and the choices they make. So, like, I think there is maybe something to it. I know there's, like, room for criticism of the kind of traditional auteur theory, but I kind of buy into it if only as, like, a sort of shorthand in how I approach and understand films and filmmakers.
Yeah. You saying this just reminds me of just how badly I really wish someone, I don't know whether it's Kino, Criterion, whoever, can just put out Michael Haneke's Austrian TV movies, like all the stuff he did before Seventh Continent.
Like his adaptation of The Castle.
Well, not even that. The Castle came out. The Castle was 97. I'm talking about stuff he did in like the mid 80s, like stuff before Seventh Continent.
Older TV stuff.
Yeah, like, because I'm so curious. Haneke's Austrian period is like his most depressing and bleak. So I'm sure there's that. But I just want to know, even before, because a lot of people will kind of present Haneke as this guy who, like, he came on the scene in 89 with the Seventh Continent. Like, he hadn't done anything before. And I just really want to see all his early stuff to see what kind of stuff, what he did and what stuff stuck and what planted the seeds for what we know now. Because I'm sure it's there. I'm just so anxious. I just really want to see that stuff. And who knows if, we'll ever get a chance.
I know people who, like, will go completely comprehensive and, like, they'll include, like, filmmakers' television commercial work and an episode of TV that they directed and sort of look at stuff like that too. And sometimes it's revealing, sometimes it's not,
Sure. I did that with my cinema of Xavier Dolan. I even included the video he directed for Adele, and stuff like that. Cause sometimes, who else?
A lot of those, like, music video directors who, like, started in music videos, like David Fincher or
yep.
Spike Jonze or people like that. Like, yep. That's hugely, important, I think, to look at where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
Or even like a Paul Thomas Anderson, when he does the occasional music video and stuff like that, it's sort of interesting to
sure
where it fits in.
And Rick Alverson has more music videos than he does feature films, but his music video work mm-hmm. ties in seamlessly with his film work.
So, thank you, Marcus, for coming on the show. very much appreciate it. And thank you for doing the music, which I'm sure people will hear playing us out right now.
Thank you for using it. I appreciate it.
If folks want to find you, where can they look?
PinlandEmpire.com, and then you can just see my additional contributed writing to ThePinkSmoke.com, Cutprint Film, and I'm on Wrong Reel all the time. I'm on FlixWise pretty regularly as well. And yeah, PinlandEmpire.com, and as far as Twitter, it's @Pinland_Empire. Yeah, follow, read, hit me up, do all those great things.
Oh, and people should definitely listen to your new podcast, Zebras in America. I'll add the link in the description. And next episode of the Mainline FlixWise, Lady P and Kristen Sells are going to be talking about Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr., so that's sure to be a good one. And they have special guest Tiffany Vasquez from TCM there to also talk about the upcoming TCM Fest. So check that out. And until then, take care.